Tech Talk on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome into Tech Talk from RNIB Connect Radio. Tech Talk, of course, is our regular journey into the world of accessible technology from a blind and partially sighted perspective. Don't forget, of course, Tech Talk is your program and we always love to hear from you. So why not drop us a line? That email address, it's techtalk@rnib.org.uk. techtalk@rnib.org.uk. Coming up this week, Callum finds out more about the Habel One Bluetooth keyboard. We journey into the world of conversational AI with Real Thing, and we'll be going low tech when we hear from a listener about how magnification has had a massive impact on their life. We will also, of course, be catching up with your email. So stay tuned. It's another Tech Talk. Welcome in to our co-hosts, Tasneem Arshad and Callum Stoneman. Good to have you back with us. Anything grabbing your attention in the world of technology this week, folks?
Hello. Yeah, I was in a computer shop recently and saw this lovely looking Surface tablet, but it was absolutely tiny. It must have been, I don't know, it can fit in the palm of your hands effectively with a lovely detachable keyboard. It was called the Gold 3. It looked very nifty. I was very impressed with it.
Did you buy it?
No, I didn't. I've already got a laptop, unfortunately, but I was seriously eyeing it up and I was like, this is amazing. I just had a feel of the keyboard and the keyboard was obviously fairly accessible, but I don't know what the spec is or anything, but it's something that you could literally fit in your handbag. That's how small it was. So I just like the portability of it really more than anything.
Yeah, it'd be good to know if anyone has a Windows tablet and how you're getting on with that. We know a lot, of course, about the iPad, but Windows tablets, anyone got one? How's it going? Callum, what's up with you?
Oh, I'm tempted. I'm really tempted by the sound of that.
Because?
I think just to try it out more than anything, you know, Windows on a touchscreen, it sounds... As you said, I think the iPad seems to kind of take over the blind world of tablets, but all the screen readers, you know, NVDA and JAWS and stuff, they do have the gestures and the functionality to work on a touchscreen, but I've never really tried it out. So it'd be interesting to see what it's like.
Well, and of course, you've got the Narrator screen reader and the Windows magnifier built in there as well. So if you've got a Windows tablet and you'd like to tell us about it, get in touch, techtalk@rnib.org.uk.
Now, you might remember a couple of weeks ago, one of our wonderful listeners emailed in to techtalk@rnib.org.uk and asked if we'd done anything on the Habel One. And we haven't, but we promised we'd look into it. And joining me now is Megan Hastings. Now, Megan, you're a user of the Habel One, right?
Yeah, so I bought one myself a year ago, must have been about now. It's actually quite a reasonable price for visual impaired technology, which sounds a bit weird to say because it's about £239, but I'm used to having to pay out much more. And it is really cool. So it's basically a little braille keyboard that you can attach. Well, it connects via Bluetooth to anything. So I use it with my iPhone all the time. So on the side, there's the on off switch and you can feel there's a bit of tactile stuff on the side where, like, for instance, you connect the charger and I think where the Bluetooth receiver is. And then on the top of it, you've got 8 buttons. So you've got your 6 dot, a bit like a Perkins Brailler or on a Braille note taker or the displays that have the note taker functionality. The space bar is in place of where your backspace would be on a Perkins or on a Braille note taker. And then the your backspace key is where your new line button would be on a Perkins, which sounds really confusing, and I do get used to it. The weird thing about it is when I took it out of the box, I expected that you would hold it flat, so you'd have it flat on the desk and type into it. And that's not actually how it works. You put your two index fingers on dots 3, 6, and so your fourth finger is then on dots 1 and 4. So you'll notice that it's also upside down. It did take me quite a while to get the hang of that, but because you're holding it in front of you to type, you actually kind of get used to it. It's really difficult to explain. So it's about the size of, so I have an iPhone 8, and it basically, I can sit it on top of my iPhone. So I do that sometimes if I've just left my phone on the desk and I'm using the Habel with it, I'll just kind of leave it on top of the iPhone. So it's about the same size. It's thicker, probably about two or three phone thicknesses. It's really light. It basically feels like one of those quite small old school phones that had like keyboard input. And that's literally all it is. So it's no screen. It makes this sort of noise when you use it. So the buttons are quite, old school sounding. But I find it really useful because I'm very braille oriented. So I do use screen reader and voiceover stuff as well. And I have a braille note taker, have done from about the age of 7. So I've used a braille note taker for about 25 years now for a lot of my reading and writing. And I find with using the iPhone, I dictate to it a lot of the time. So I just speak what I want to say. And then I know how to go through and edit the messages so that when it comes out with rubbish that I didn't mean to send, I can correct it and make it say what I actually wanted to say before I press the send button. And there are times where actually dictating isn't so great, like if I'm in a public space or just even around like my friends or other people. Okay, so I can lower my voice a bit to dictate, but then the phone doesn't always pick up what I actually wanted to say. And also, I don't really want people in public to know what I'm saying to everyone. So in things like meetings or if I'm in a public space like on a train, it's really good to be able to type in my own way on this Habel one. Yeah, I also find it really useful occasionally. I mean, I generally, if I was going to send quite a long email and I had my laptop, I would sit down at my laptop and do it because I'm a touch typist and I would, just use the keyboard entry. But on the Habel one, it's really useful. If I've just got my phone and I want to send quite a substantial email, that say a few paragraphs, or I want to make sure that what I'm typing is accurate enough to start with, that I don't have to go through it word by word and make sure it's all spelt right, then I find it really useful. The Habel one's also been really useful because it's so portable and light and small. I used to take my laptop with me a lot when I was traveling. And it is heavier and takes up more space than this. So now I'll just take my phone and the Habel one. And basically, it means that if I need to write anything too chunky, I can just get out the Habel one and do it that way. Yeah, there does seem to be a bit of a glitch with turning the Habel one on and off and it affecting the dictation. So I have it sometimes where if I've turned the Habel one off and then I dictate to my phone, the dictation won't work. And I'm not really sure why that is. I think it's something to do with the Bluetooth connection and disconnection, but it's quite easy to set up. You get a user manual with it as a Word document. I've got mine as, but I think you can get it in different formats. It tells you what dot combinations do and also how to navigate the phone using the Habel one, which I don't do very much, to be fair. I tend to just use the touch screen to navigate, and I literally just use this to write. Just because there's a lot of different key combinations on the Habel one to do different things on the phone. But it is quite cool to do. I just don't often do it. Yeah, so it's quite easy to set up, quite easy to connect to the you'd basically just set up a Bluetooth connection on whatever device. So now, like with my phone, it's got Habel one there. And whenever I turn the Habel one on, it connects straight to Bluetooth. It's got quite good battery life. Because I generally just turn it on, write a few sentences, and then turn it back off again. I don't tend to leave it on because then, if you leave the Habel one on, I can't then type or do or dictate into my phone. So I have to turn it off when I'm not using it. But it's just got like a little slider switch, and when you turn on the slider switch, you may have heard that little noise. That was it vibrating to say I've turned myself on now. But yeah, it doesn't talk, and it doesn't have a screen. And I know some people have talked a bit about that they might like a screen. My only thing really that would improve it for me would be that it is a bit odd, like typing upside down. It took me a while to get used to because my fingers are kind of trained to the positions that they would be on the Perkins, and also holding it. You kind of hold it in landscape view in front of you. So you hold it in your two hands and then tuck your thumbs underneath it. It did take me some getting used to that because I'm used to typing flat. So yeah, it'd be great if there was an option where you could choose which way round you wanted to have it. Because when I first got it, I was always, in fact, I still do it sometimes. I'll type like a letter in Braille and then see which letter my phone tells me I'm typing. Because I it's very easy for me to just pick it up and turn it round the wrong way and type the wrong way round. But overall, I mean, I don't regret buying it. It's definitely the most useful Bluetooth keyboard I've had, and it suits me because, you know, I learned Braille at the age of 4. Braille input is really natural to me. It's kind of how my brain works. But that's also partly why this fingers being in different positions thing just messed with my brain, and I had to figure it out. But yeah, I would say definitely the best. You know, I've bought all sorts of little pocket sized QWERTY Bluetooth keyboards over the years, you know, like a laptop keyboard, but because they're so small and the keys have been squashed so close together, I just didn't find it worked very well for me. Whereas this, I like it. It's lightweight. It's very useful for what it does. I'm interested to see if they do develop this product and what they do with it. It'll be quite interesting to see.
Yeah, it does sound really interesting. I mean, I guess the glitch you mentioned there with dictation and stuff, I guess that's kind of hard to tell with these sorts of products, isn't it? Whether it's the product's fault or whether it's an issue with iOS and the way that that's handling the Bluetooth connection. But I'm intrigued by the whole, you mentioned about the, there's not really a space bar. It's kind of in place of where the backspace key would be, I think you said.
Yeah.
But how does that kind of work if you needed to kind of type in a space or if you needed to do what the...
That's true, actually. I didn't explain that. So the space bar, you just hit this. It's got like a long key on either side. Again, a bit like an enter and a backspace key on a Perkins. So you hit it for a space bar. But if you want to do a new line, you do .4 and the space bar key together. And there are all sorts of commands like that, different combinations of dots with these long keys that do all sorts of different... that like navigational things on the phone. So like you can do anything that you would do on the phone, scrolling left and right, selecting anything like that, going back to the home screen. I think going back to the home screen might be letter H with one of the long keys. I don't do it enough to remember. When I got it, I had the document of command because the instruction manual has all the commands in it, and I had it open and I would literally go through and test them all. But they've just not, because I've not done it, they've not stuck with me in my head. So I can't really be bothered with that because generally, I mean, on a train, I'd be using my phone with my headphones anyway, but I'm still relying on the voice feedback from my phone to tell me what I'm doing. So if I'm not using it with headphones, I'm just using the Hable One. It's like, well, I may as well just do it myself, the navigation, and get that feedback anyway.
I guess that's one thing to be clear about with this. I mean, you did mention it, but it's not traditionally we'd kind of expect a Braille display and keyboard, but this is literally just input, isn't it? You don't get the output. It doesn't.
No, that's true. And I'm not sure I'd want to read my iPhone on a Braille display, to be honest. That's partly why, because I've got no problem with the voice feedback and I've got no problem with navigating the phone. The only thing that annoys me is dictating and then having to go through. And I can type on the phone, you know, on the touchscreen. It's just so slow for me. Like my typing speed is like 75 words per minute on a QWERTY keyboard and a Braille note taker. So this is much better. One of the things I do find, actually, because I do type quite fast on it, the keys stick a bit sometimes. And also I find that sometimes the contractions don't. So say if I wrote, how about that ? On this keyboard, it would sometimes put how about, and then it would say T ? Because it's like the T, which is single T is that in grade 2 Braille. It's like it hasn't had time to become that contraction before I added the question mark. So I have to be quite careful to check over, but I have a lot of things like where if I type me, it'll often just come up as an N where the M and the E have run together and the .5 has got. So it's like it's sort of like it can't keep up with my typing speed. But I don't know if it, there's two things really, isn't there? There's the keyboard and then there's how it interacts with the phone. So this glitch about dictation, is that a phone glitch or is it just how the two things work together, you know? So that those are a couple of problems I have experienced with it.
Yeah, but I guess that's one thing with this that you don't get with the QWERTY keyboards that you can buy, that with this you can take advantage of the grade 2 braille, which can, that on its own can massively improve your typing speed.
Yeah. Now you do have to set that up as well. So when you set it up, that like your Apple, well, my iPhone anyway, has loads of braille input settings on it. So you change them on the phone. So you could just input into grade 1. That's up to you. I personally choose, and you can choose 6 or 8 dot braille mode, which I've never really understood, but I think that's something to do with computer braille. Those settings apply if you're connecting your, you know, your braille note taker or display to the phone as well. So it just basically treats it like a, like another braille display or a braille input device that you're connecting. I have to say that with, when I normally see a bit of VI, you know, technology like braille note takers, that I think, oh yeah, actually that could be really useful to me, especially if I'm buying it from new, because it's so expensive, I would look at where I can get a demo. I'm often not willing to go to Site Village to like the exhibition of technology to look at something. But if it is possible to have a home demo, or to get, you know, to ask to have like a demo version sent to me in the post for me to look at and then send back, I would do that. Because this came from RNIB, I wasn't aware of any demos that I could tap into. When I looked at it and it saw it was only £230, I thought, well, I'll buy it and then I can at least try it. And if I really don't like it, I'll sell it on, because there are people out there who'll have technology secondhand. So it was a bit of a gamble for me. But yeah, I'm really glad that I was able to just go for it, really, because... I think it's quite cool for what it does.
It is a good price for a bit of specialist tech especially, but there are slightly cheaper keyboards out there, such as the Orbit Writer.
It's very cool what they are doing now in terms of new braille technology and making it cheaper and more affordable. So I can see that with, if they were going to look at developing this project, probably like a lot of braille note takers, it could get thinner and sleeker, possibly. But the thickness of it doesn't bother me too much. Although, so I use the Braille Sense U2, and I used to use a Braille Note Apex from Humanware. And I would say that they are both thinner than this. So it does, in its thickness and the kind of plasticky feel, it's a bit more like a slightly older style note taker. But it is nowhere near as big. So even though it's thicker, it's still pocket sized, but it's... The size of it is, as I said, it's smaller than an iPhone. So actually, if it was bigger, yeah, it wouldn't be as portable. But I literally just shove it in the bottom of my rucksack. I mean, it weighs nothing. Very lightweight.
I mean, you seem like quite a braille expert, I would say. Certainly better than me. But do you think you need to be a braillist necessarily to use this? I mean, obviously, you've got to have some familiarity with, you know, typing in braille. But do you think you need to be... particularly proficient?
No, in fact, probably if you were less proficient or less fast anyway, it might do you a favor, because you wouldn't get this stuff with the keys sticking. It is unnatural for me to type at this kind of weird angle where it's really hard to describe it, but my hands are sort of facing away from me rather than typing down flat. So rather than the pressure of my fingers going down onto keys, so they're going on sort of sideways at an angle. And I wonder if that's why the keys are sticking as well, because I'm not used to typing in that way. And the keys themselves are just like little buttons. They're quite big for buttons. It's probably similar to some of the braille displays that have the note taker input. So they're not like, they're not long keys like on a Perkins or on some of the note takers, like the ones I use, the Sense and the Humanware ones. So they're more, the keys, the dots 1 to 6 are more like buttons. But yeah, I think even if you were just learning grade 1 braille, it depends. I mean, for me, it's all about me preferring that over dictating into my phone. But you could do use this with other devices as well. In fact, one of the things I've never thought of is if I had to use a computer without a screen reader to type something in, I would feel comfortable just typing onto a QWERTY onto the keyboard. But the other way I could do it is with this Habil 1, to at least type what I know I'm typing in Braille and then get somebody to check it or whatever, if I didn't have access to a screen reader.
Okay, well, very, very interesting and very nice review of the Habil 1 there. Megan, thanks for joining us.
No worries.
Thanks very much to Callum Stoneman and Megan Hastings there for their description of Habel One. And tune in next week when we'll be speaking with Habel One themselves and learning more about the company and development of the product. You're listening to Tech Talk on RNIB Connect Radio. I'm Dave Williams. Now, many of us have become very used to speaking with our smart speakers, smartphones and devices. But do those things really know what we want or what we're saying? Well, someone who has worked tirelessly in this area is Nick Howden from Real Thing AI. And Nick joins us now. Welcome to Tech Talk, Nick. It's really good to have you with us. Just talk, if you would, a little bit about your journey. How did you get into conversational AI?
Yeah, thanks very much, Dave. It's fabulous to be here. So my background, I've worked in AI for more than 25 years now. And initially, I was working with defense and the military on modeling human behavior. So we used a technology we call intelligent software agents. And these were software entities that model a kind of a simple level of human decision making and human reasoning. And we used those for military acquisition people to make decisions about what sorts of platforms they might like to buy and to run simulations around how those things performed in the real world and how they performed under various different scenarios and all that sort of thing. So that was what we call closed loop simulations. So basically you could run thousands of different scenarios all very, very quickly and decide how things would play out. But a key part of that is the human in the middle of it all making decisions about what they're going to do and how they're going to behave and how they're going to act. So that was some of the first work that we started doing in AI. And over time, myself and in fact the core team that's now at Real Thing has worked over a number of different companies on this AI engine and applying it to a whole lot of different things, including flying drones, teams of flying drones, and coordinating their activities between the various entities. And more recently, realized that the AI underlying this was actually really good at pursuing and understanding human goals and intentions, and that this is actually a core part of human dialogue. So human language is often about trying to understand what the other person's saying and then trying to assist them to achieve a particular outcome. It might be to give them instructions or to get somewhere or to do something like that. And so this engine, we realized quickly, was a fabulous powerhouse, if you like, that could help deliver conversational AI, so conversations between humans and computers. And then not long after that, we started working with blind and vision impaired people and realized that obviously voice interfaces are a key way of accessing information and services for people who are vision impaired. So and so hence have been working in this space ever since, and it's been amazingly rewarding.
That's quite a leap, isn't it? Going from sort of drones and, controlling sort of military hardware and making decisions about that and trying to interpret, the intention of an operative on the ground to conversational-based tech. So your engine sits behind the actual speech recognition. Am I understanding that correctly? So that there's actually, a module doing the kind of the speech recognition bit, and then where you come in is actually sort of behind that, is to try and understand what did the user actually want.
That's exactly right. Yeah, so there's multiple layers in a speech application. As you've indicated, that the front layer is converting the sound into text to understand what the actual words were that were uttered. And then on the way out, likewise, converting the text back into sound so that the computer can speak. But in between those two, there's a big body of work around, so those words were uttered, what do they mean, and what is the user's intention in uttering them, and therefore, how should we respond? And that's really at the core of conversational AI, and that's where our Real Thing AI platform kicks in. That's the power of it.
Yeah, we've all got those examples, haven't we, of when we've sort of asked a device to do something and it's come back with a, you know, a sort of seemingly ridiculous response. My favourite one was I went to send a mate of mine a text message, and I asked Siri to tell my mate that he needed to remind me that I owed him a fiver. And I think she said, here's your message to Dave. I owe you a Eurofighter. do you want to send it? I think I said yes. So where did you sort of first come across blind people? Do you have a kind of a personal interest in sight loss? Where did that come from?
A number of different threads, actually. Our CTO has a reasonable amount of sight loss, our chief technology officer. And we actually, I'm from Australia, and our kind of core tech team is based there. And we actually started working with Vision Australia there, and started sort of working with them on, you know, what are the things that are currently problematic, and, you know, how can voice best be utilised. And actually the thing we came up with initially was reading newspapers. So, you know, there were solutions for reading books and a whole lot of those things, and books is not so time critical, but news is one of those things that, you know, you need to read it now, otherwise it's old and it's not that interesting to read it next week. So that was the first thing we did. Actually, we developed a news reading application that you could browse articles and search and jump from section to section and do all of those sorts of things. And that's actually how we first engaged with RNIB here in the UK too. We basically, a friend of mine who was the Disability Discrimination Commissioner in Australia sent one of our devices across to someone at RNIB, and they absolutely loved it. So we started engaging with RNIB here in the UK and have since developed it into a whole range of different products, working hand in hand with organisations. In fact, across the globe, we're now in the US as well.
Yeah, and we have spoken on Tech Talk about, you know, Real Sam in your pocket, and, you know, it'd be good to touch on the Real Hub. I just wanted to just finally ask you one more thing about the sort of the technology behind this, because you talk at Real Thing about being context and intention aware. And now obviously you'll have, you know, protected intellectual property, but are you able to give us any sense of how that works?
Absolutely, yeah. So look, I think the way I like to describe it is that most of the interactions that people have with things like Siri and Alexa and Google and so on are what we call one shots. So effectively they are, you say something and it's a command, you know, it might be turn on the lights or play me a song by David Bowie, and then you get a response and you're done. You know, that's it. That's the interaction. It's more of a verbal command than a conversation. So going forward with voice interfaces, as we want to do more and more complex things, we're going to need to do a lot more powerful stuff than just verbal commands, because a conversation involves two sides and it involves multiple steps. So the first thing is multi-step conversations, and you know, Google and so on can do some of those. I mean, you mentioned sending a text. There's often a couple of steps in sending, and then it checks that you want to send, and then off you go. But, you know, other conversations, I mean, for example, reading a newspaper, that's actually something that you're browsing and you're going backwards and forwards and you're going to the next article and you're searching for things and you're doing, you know, that's an ongoing conversation with lots of different steps to it. So one thing is the kind of multi-step interactions. The other key differentiator is about what we call multi-threaded conversations. So humans naturally talk, you know, you have multi-steps and you might be talking, we might be talking now about this, and then you might say, oh, actually, we've only got 5 minutes left. You know, can we talk about something else? And we have a little aside, or someone might say, oh, I'm just nipping out to get coffee. Does anyone want a coffee? And we have a quick conversation about the coffee, and then we go back to what we were talking about. So those totally separate conversational threads that kind of interweave with each other, again, is a very human and natural way of interacting. But the speech platforms that are out there at the moment from the large tech firms can't do any of that sort of stuff. So that's one of the sort of powerful elements of Real Thing AI's platform, is you can actually have multiple conversational threads and you can jump backwards and forwards. You know, you could be reading the newspaper, you can send a text, you can check the weather in Paris, and then you can go back to reading your newspaper. And all those threads are still there. And that's the power that we believe that we need if we're going to start using these conversational interfaces for more things than just, you know, turning on the lights.
Yeah. Do you think there are differences in the needs of blind and partially sighted people when it comes to conversational AI compared with the wider audience of sighted people?
I think the difference is that, you know, someone who's totally blind actually will utilise this more powerfully. So, I mean, examples I always have is if you're using Alexa, sometimes you ask it something and it'll say, "I'll go to the Alexa app on your phone." You know, that's its response. Now, that's if you're dealing with someone who can't interact via a touchscreen, then that's not an acceptable response. You need to do it in voice through the interface that you're currently using. And so that's a kind of laziness, I see it, you know, on the part of those tech firms. So I think that's really the major difference. You know, once we get this kind of conversational AI out there and more people are using it, then I don't think there will be a huge difference. I think everyone will want to talk and so on to their devices. And a classic one is if you're driving, for example, your hands and your eyes and other things are occupied, and so the voice is the only thing left. And so that's a classic case where someone who's sighted and someone who's not, you know, have a big overlap where they just have to use voice and that's the only thing they have available.
What would you say to folks who are concerned about privacy? You know, we've all got devices now that are, you know, effectively listening, and how that information, you know, is stored and processed is obviously an area of great interest. What assurances would you offer?
Look, I think it is an absolutely huge area, and it is something that we do, you know, we as consumers do need to be concerned about. I think inherently at the moment, most of the voice platforms use cloud-based processing. So yes, your data, your voice, all that stuff does zip up to the cloud and is accessible. And, you know, this is what you're referring to, but the large tech firms we've discovered are also pumping that out to third world countries for people to listen to process and do all that sort of stuff. So, you know, all of a sudden you start to worry about where all of your voice and so on is going. And I think it is a legitimate concern. I think the ways we can address that is that as devices become more powerful, and one of the things we're working on at Real Thing at the moment is to actually move the AI platform onto the handset so that in fact your interactions are actually local. You're talking to the device, it's processing them and it's responding, and all that data is held in your hand. It's not going off to some, you know, big cloud processing. And I think that, one, it's more responsive and you can use it in the tube and things like that, but also it addresses that privacy aspect because, you know, you've got it in the palm of your hand and you know what's happening to it.
Do you think one of the goals of conversational AI is to pass the Turing test? Maybe we should just explain for everyone what the Turing test is. This is a long-standing challenge in computer science to try and, well, you probably explain it better than I would, but to essentially convince a human that they're talking to another human, not a machine.
Yeah, exactly. So people might be familiar with the captures, you know, that say click on all the traffic lights or you know, those sorts of things. That's, if you like, a reverse Turing test. That's to prove that you are not a robot, you know, that you are human. And in a sense, those are sorts of things that computers can't do very well. And so therefore, it is a differentiator. I think in terms of conversational AI, we're getting better. I think we're getting a lot better in that regard. Well, better. We're getting closer to being able to pass a test like that, where you couldn't differentiate whether you're talking to a human or a machine. But at the heart of it, we're still some way off. I mean, our engine is about, I would put it kind of at the intelligence level of a reptile or something like that, where it's, you know, it can balance its goals and it can pursue things and it can hunt and it can, you know, look after itself and seek safety and do all those sorts of things. But, you know, having a high level sort of abstract conversation, you're always going to be able to trip it up and know that it's not human. So I think we're still some way off from actually achieving true general AI in that sense. But we're getting closer to, at least in a sort of trivial way, you know, pass the Turing test where people say, "Oh, was that not a human that I was talking to?"
And we'll be hearing more from Nick from Real Thing a little bit later on in the show.
It's not all about talking devices here on Tech Talk. People who are partially sighted, you'll be using magnification. And Tasneem Arshad now is along hearing from a listener for whom magnification has transformed their life.
Welcome, Ashrafia, and thank you for joining us at Tech Talk.
Oh, yes, and thank you for having me.
Yes, you're very welcome. Just to kick us off then, can you give us a brief summary of your background?
My name's Ashrafia and I've been visually impaired for about 30 years now. I wasn't born with an eye condition. I got to secondary school at the age of 11 and I started to notice that I couldn't really make out people's faces and I couldn't see the writing on the board. So that's how that all started. I was diagnosed with a condition called Stargardt's. Basically, in a nutshell, it means I don't have central vision. So I've got a lot of useful peripheral vision. I'm registered as sight impaired, partially sighted.
Okay, that sounds really interesting. And I can't imagine how difficult it must be for you being diagnosed later on. I wonder what that was like for you.
Well, it was very confusing because that's one thing I wasn't expecting. Nobody else in the family or my circle of relatives, friends, you name it. I've never come across sight loss, so I didn't really understand it. And I don't think anybody around me really understood it. So I was misdiagnosed a lot. And the whole process was quite traumatic. And then when I did finally get my diagnosis, it's like a grieving period. I can't explain it to you. So I'd say for the first 10 years, I didn't really speak to anyone or tell anyone. I think no one really understood what had happened. I couldn't really explain it. And back then, children were expected to translate. So I should have said, I'm originally a British Bangladeshi. I was born here, but my family, mum, dad are from Bangladesh. So, you know, we hadn't come across all of this and, you know, there's a taboo and a stigma attached to visual impairment. So the whole experience wasn't good, but 30 years down, I'm a totally different person altogether, thanks to low vision.
Wow. It sounds, you know, it sounds like an incredibly powerful emotional journey that I can imagine, you know, a lot of people with sight loss can relate to.
There wasn't much stuff out there in the school I went to. They really didn't understand. So I didn't get the help and support. I wish I'd spoken out more, but then I didn't know what was on offer. So what you don't know is what you don't know. My family didn't really fully understand what was going on. You know, little things that most of the viewers listening will be able to relate. Well, how is she crossing that road? I mean, how does she do that? She says she can't see. How does she get dressed? I mean, for goodness sake, how does she get to school? She says she can't see, but she seems to be managing okay. But, you know, listeners that are listening in, they know that peripheral vision, and we've got our techniques and styles of how we get to place and how we do things. We actually adapt very well without even realising we're very resilient. So we just get up and get on with it.
Yeah. And talking of that resilience and getting on with it, can you share with us how you did that, Ashrafia?
Well, after I'd reached the end of my sight loss journey, I was referred to a place called the Low Vision Aid. And that's where it really all started off. And I was issued with different handheld magnifiers. I have to tell you, I wasn't really happy with it because that's not what I really wanted at the end of the day. At the end of the day, I wanted a pair of new eyes. You know, I thought, here I was going to get a new pair of eyes. And once I could get away from the initial idea that that wasn't going to happen, and that's a process in itself, that took time to fully engage and understand that I wasn't going to get what I wanted. And once I could initially get through that hurdle, I was given these magnifiers, and it's just something I really didn't want to use. I think I was getting in the way of myself. I was really worried what people would think of me. I looked very odd. I looked very strange. As people listening in, when you've got low vision aid, you have to look really closely at things. You're on top of it. If you don't get on top of it, you're not going to see it. And I think I was given these magnifiers. And I think for me, I got fed up of having to share information that I didn't want others to know. For example, I was reaching the age where I was getting private mail and I just didn't want to read it. Now, I was born in the 70s, so people still wrote on paper. So I come from a generation where pens and paper and people wrote. There was no email, there was no smartphone. And I wasn't able to see to read the letters I was getting. And I was like, goodness me. And the biggest one was bank statements. How on earth was I going to do all of this? So I gave it a go, got out my magnifiers, and there was no stopping me from that moment onwards. So I've got a variety of magnifiers with all different strengths, depending on the font size and the style and what it is that I'm trying to achieve. Some come with lights, some come with no lights, different stars, different shapes, whole variety. So I use a whole variety depending on what the task is that I'm trying to do.
It sounds like you could open up your own low vision clinic.
Yeah, I definitely know a lot about low vision magnifiers and bits and pieces. I'm a big fan. You know, we've got all this super tech out these days, smartphones and gadgets and laptops and iPads, talking this and talking that. But I always, even today, I still carry a magnifier in my handbag, just in case any of this stuff lets me down.
Tell me more about this favoured piece of kit you've got hidden in your handbag.
It's a round one, it's a pocket size, and it just fits really nicely into your hand. It's a 10 times, and it just flips open. It doesn't really catch anyone's eye, and I just put it into my purse. Often people think it's a mirror or something, and whenever I need to see a price of a size, an item, a price, anything like that, if I was shopping for a garment, or maybe I picked up something and I just wanted to check the ingredients, I can quickly get a snapshot of it quite easily with that. You can also put a string around it if you wanted to. And when I was in my teens, I was interviewed by somebody and I said, I love this piece of kit, if only if it had a light. Because obviously you have to get up really close. So when the closer you get, the darker things become, because you're that natural light can't get in. I said it would be so amazing somebody could actually put a light on this. And I think a couple of years ago, it now comes with a light. So I was just like jumping up and down when somebody said to me, oh my goodness, it now comes with a light. So I thought somebody out there must have heard me. So now I've got one with a light.
Okay, that sounds interesting, because I also had, I was a print user at primary school and secondary school and part through college as well. And I remember having something very similar to what you've described, a round handheld pocket magnifying glass, which I use quite a lot to use, you know, when I was studying for my GCSEs. But it wasn't as strong as a 10. I think it was like maybe an 8 for magnification. And actually, I would have preferred it to be stronger, because the magnification wasn't as strong as I would like it to have been. It didn't have a light on it, but it was very discreet. So I can really relate to what you're saying, and with regards to this trusted magnifying glass, because I use mine quite a lot as well as sort of CCTVs too. So this one travels everywhere with you out and about, and it sounds like it's really useful outdoors. Okay, so what else do you have in your stash, Ashrafia? I'm quite interested to know what other magnifications you have and how you use them.
Well, I've got all the different handheld. I like the illuminated handheld magnifiers, and I've forgotten that special light they use. Oh, tell me about a light. You know, there's different. There's the white light and there's a yellow light. There's all these different lights. Different people like different lights. I think I like the white one quite bright light. The more light I have, the happier I am. So I'm a fan of these products. So I've got them in all different strengths, from right down from a 6 times to an 8 times to a 12 times, all different strengths. Because sometimes some things are so small, like you want to see a barcode. So I do need a stronger magnifier, like a 12 times, so I can get right down and see the small little detail that I need to.
Okay. So what other tasks do you use the magnifications for?
They're just helpful for everything. I mean, everything you need to read, don't you? Right from, you know, like I've got monoculars. I've got a monocular, which is one. I've got telescopes, binoculars. I've got the whole range, right from, I mean, if I wanted to see someone's door number, how would I do that? I'd have to get out my monocular if the bus was coming, you know, binocular. So all different things.
So you use the monocular to read bus numbers?
Yeah, definitely. I would say I use the binocular when I'm on the underground. I need to know when the train is pulling up, what direction it's going on. So that's when the monocular comes in handy. I call that spot seeing. You know, you just need to glance to see where the bus is coming. So you roughly have an idea, you just want to make out what the bus number is. That's really handy for that. And then I recently got binoculars, and that was really handy because when I went on holiday, I was looking for someone, and then I was able to look with my binoculars roughly where they were, because I'd already known what they were wearing, what colours they were wearing. So I didn't really need to recognise them. I just needed to know what part of the, where are they standing? So when I went down, that would be easier for me to find them rather than me getting down there and getting lost.
Yeah, I'm really impressed with your wide range of magnification resources, and actually how you utilize them in all these different settings. I mean, even when I had pretty good vision, I'm not sure I'd be getting out the monocular to look at a bus number. I mean, I just think that's incredible. How do you feel when you're doing that and you're just getting the monocular out very quickly and checking out the bus number? How do you find that?
Well, with the monocular, I didn't know anything different. So I used to work in London. I actually used to live in Hertfordshire. So there was no way I'd be able to do the commute without using the monocular. So if I didn't use it, I wasn't getting on the train. There was, because audio didn't exist then. So there was no audio cue. So if I didn't know what direction or where I was going, I would never get to where I'm going. And first thing in the morning, people aren't that helpful, because everyone's busy. And to look at me, you can't tell I've got an eye condition or anything wrong with me at all. So I'm like, well, you need to get your monocular. I didn't really think about it. I was quite young at the time. I just thought, I need to get there. I didn't really look at it like now that I'm older, I'm more paranoid. I wish I wasn't. I wish I didn't care. When I was younger, I didn't care. It's really weird. I think when I was young, I didn't realise how ignorant the world is. I just thought everybody was lovely. Everybody was like me. Everybody's so accommodating. Everybody's so helpful. So only when I got older and I thought, no, people aren't as nice as I thought. And I thought it's also my job at the same time. So I don't shy away. I could easily use a bit of kit, a modern bit of kit, if I was shopping for a birthday card, but I don't. I deliberately will use a magnifier just so when people walk past, I want to raise awareness like that. I want to let people know that there are people like me who are everyday people, go about their lives, have children, and, you know, have sight problems. Because most people relate sight loss to older people, or you have to look a certain way. They don't relate it to people like me. So I think it's my job to, whenever I can, to get the aids out. And even when I go to meetings, I deliberately will leave them on the table and around. So people say, what's that? So I want to start up a conversation.
Yeah, I think that's great that we can all be ambassadors for sight loss in that way. So yeah, that's totally brilliant, Ashrafia. So I wonder what your thoughts are on video magnifying glasses.
You're talking about the video magnifiers, aren't you? I've used those before, but at the time when I adapted to that, the smartphones came out. So if I had a choice, I'd go with the smartphone. I think that's almost like being redundant. For me, there are people out there that haven't made that transition from magnifier to the smart devices. So that's the in-between. I've almost like jumped from the magnifier to the smart devices.
Have you tried video magnifying glasses? Sorry, video magnifiers.
Yes, I have. But I'm a lot quicker with my smart devices and all the different apps on the phone.
Would you recommend video magnifiers to people?
If somebody who wasn't that techie and they're a bit nervous about getting a smartphone, yes, definitely, because there are lots of people who find smartphones and things like quite intimidating, quite scary. I know myself, when I was introduced to a smartphone, when, you know, this touch screen, it was quite alien to me. I was like, touch screen? I can barely use one with all the buttons on it. What do you mean it's got no home button on it? It's all very scary stuff. So, yeah, I think for the transition, definitely start off with a video magnifier.
So what you're saying, Ashrafia, is you've got your wide collection of magnifying glasses, your traditional ones, and between that and the smartphone, or between them and the smartphone, it's a really very effective and robust method for you.
Yeah, definitely. The world is my oyster, as they say. I can't believe I'm the woman I am with all this stuff. It's given me so much independence. I can go everywhere, you know, on my phone, you know, all that anxiety. I need my monocular. When's that bus coming? Stress, stress, stress. Oh my God, am I going to miss the bus and all that? I can sit at home, put my app on, know exactly when the bus is coming, walk very casually down the road, stand, wait, and I know because my phone is telling me that my bus is arriving in the next 2 minutes.
Thank you to Ashrafia for sharing your very powerful experiences there.
We've had an email from Richard Foster in Aberdeen, who describes himself as a 71-year-old codger who doesn't always have a great relationship with technology. He says he thought that it would amuse us that he was struggling to perform a double tap. He's had several unsuccessful attempts, and he assumed that it was because his finger didn't always land exactly in the same place. He only recently discovered that he was doing it wrong. I think it was a timing issue. And that can be quite tricky, can't it, guys? When you're starting out with using a screen reader on a smartphone, you've got to get that double tap just right. And actually, VoiceOver on iPhone, I know, just doesn't care whereabouts on the screen you perform that double tap, does it? It will activate the last thing that was spoken, but your sort of double tap needs to be kind of, you know, sort of quite quickly, really.
Yeah, very snappy. Yeah, I think we can kind of forget about the really simple, basic gestures sometimes, can't you? But yeah, I mean, it's you know, it can be a tricky one to get the hang of. Another way of doing it as well, which I know some people find easier, is to kind of keep one finger on the screen and then kind of tap the screen with another finger, if that makes sense. So you kind of say you're on the weather icon, you could have one finger kind of held down on the weather icon and just tap with a second finger. That will also perform the kind of double tap equivalent.
Oh, that sounds really interesting. I think it's really lovely that Richard has shared that. And I think I'd like to, you know, rename him as Silver Surfer instead of Old Codger. I think that's more fitting.
Thanks so much for your email. Callum, I think this one is probably for you. Jeanette has been in touch about the Ring doorbell. You remember you provided us with that wonderful demonstration of the Ring doorbell quite a while ago. And Jeanette is wondering about the app. You recommended a third-party app, Rapid Ring?
Yeah, Rapid Ring. Yeah,
so she's struggling to find that on the App Store. Do you know, is it still available?
So, yes, since that demo was recorded and, well, since it went on air, actually, it has been discontinued. So as of, I think, July, Ring have discontinued it. So, yeah, if you've still got the app, then you can use it until further notice, which I think just means it will work until it doesn't. But yeah, they've removed it from app stores now. They're no longer supporting it. So you just need to use the standard Ring app, which it is fine. It's a bit clunky and a bit, you know, it can be a bit fiddly, but it does work. It is, you know, accessible. But yeah, unfortunately, Rapid Ring has gone now.
So is there not a replacement for that then, Callum? Somebody else coming in with a different, you know, that did the same thing as Rapid Ring?
Well, not really, because the Rapid Ring was their app. It was just an alternative way of a kind of lighter way of accessing the doorbell live feed. But yeah, they've just tied everything into the main app now.
And finally, Derry Lawler has been in touch talking about accessible watches. And Derry, hopefully you enjoyed our review of the Habel One keyboard. Derry says he'd like to know more about it before making a purchase because they are a little bit pricey.
It's a good point. You know, the Habel one is a bit on the pricey side, I guess, for a keyboard. I mean, there are cheaper options. You know, the Orbit Writer, if you wanted that kind of Braille input, then the Orbit Writer is a little bit cheaper. I mean, there's always just the option of a regular Bluetooth QWERTY keyboard. But I think, as Megan said there, it's the portability of the Habel one. But yeah, it's whatever works for you, ultimately, I suppose.
Okay, Derry, let us know what you decide. And if you'd like to drop us a line here at Tech Talk, you can, of course, email techtalk@rnib.org.uk. Callum, Tasneem, thanks very much.
We return now to Dave's conversation with Nick Howden from Real Thing AI.
As a company, Nick, you've had a number of announcements recently, not least of which was RealSam is now available in the US.
That's exactly right. Yeah, so we've just recently launched the RealSam Pocket device in the US. Last week, I was at a conference in Washington, the Blinded Veterans Association conference, and the feedback has been fantastic. You know, people see it as a fabulous device for people who are maybe older and not quite as tech savvy and can't deal with the accessibility features on an iPhone. And just want something extremely simple that they can just tap the button and talk to and access all of the the communications and entertainment and accessibility and independence features of RealSam Pocket. So that's going fabulously well at the moment. Pocket in the US. The other stuff that we're working on at the moment in the US, we're actually working with the Library of Congress, which is actually the largest library in the world. They also have the largest accessible book collection, audiobooks and other formats. And we're working with them to make that available through, again, a conversational AI interface on devices and on smart speakers, Google and Alexa. We're just about to start running a trial with them, and we'll see how that goes, and look forward to that being made available more generally as well. So that's very exciting.
Can you tell me about RealSam Hub?
Sure. Yeah. So the RealSam Hub is really the concept is it's a hub, a sort of single place that you can go for accessing information and entertainment and so on for people who are visually impaired. So you can access the hub via smart speakers, Google Home and Amazon Alexa. You can also actually access it via pretty much anywhere you can get Alexa or Google. So you can actually get it on, I think someone even accessed it on their heater thermostat controller, which I thought was fairly entertaining. But basically, yeah, it's an aggregation of a voice interface and a means of accessing, a whole range of different sort of content, entertainment, and also information. We're actually working with a number of charities about a sort of a tell me about feature. So you could say, tell me about Torch Trust or tell me about RNIB and get some information and access to things like podcasts and so on about those organisations for people who are seeking information about their sort of local blindness organisations.
And what lies ahead? I mean, I know you obviously will be working on things behind the scenes, but what do you see as being the main sort of challenges going forward?
I mean, voice is really exploding at the moment. And I think, I'm actually here talking to a number of organisations, in fact, across the world, about their voice strategy and what they're planning to do with voice and how they're going to offer their services and so on to the community using voice. And obviously the fabulous thing about that is that voice is accessible inherently, so, for people who are vision impaired. So as companies kind of develop their voice strategy and their voice interfaces, that will be a lot simpler for people who are vision impaired to access. And the key, I think, will be that the real step change will be once companies allow you to access more complex services by voice. So, as we've talked about, there's the one-shot rules of turning on the light and so on. But, I don't know, booking a train fare, for example, wouldn't it be great if you could say, call up your train company on the speaker and then just chat away about which seat you want and which train and which fare and which stations you'll be getting on and off at and all that sort of stuff, and then have it book you a ticket without having to sit down at a computer and go to a website. So I think those are probably the exciting things that are going to come, offering more and more complex services and interactions using voice. And that's really what we're talking to companies about, and hopefully they can start to make those steps over the coming year or two.
Well, and particularly at the moment, we're all thinking about cost of living, being able to negotiate price comparison services to make sure that you're getting the best deal, and doing that, in a kind of a voice first sort of way would be tremendously helpful, because I don't know about you, I find those websites just really confusing and hard work, and you try and do that with a screen reader. You know, I'm a pretty competent screen reader user, but I just lose the will to live filling in all those forms, you know, and it'd be great to know that I'm just getting the best deal for my gas and electricity or my groceries, or if I want a hotel or something like that. So yeah, lots of areas to look into, I guess.
Absolutely. Look, I think energy companies would be a great target for that sort of thing. The other area that we're talking to people about, and it references the same thing, where you've often got kind of visual tables and things that don't translate well with a screen reader, is surveying. You know, people often say, can you please fill out our survey, or, you know, give us a response on this? And sometimes these surveys are quite important because they drive government policy about, you know, how to best address the sector, or how to compensate people for energy bills, or those sorts of things. And so we're actually looking at and working with a number of organisations at the moment on a kind of voice-based survey tool to address the similar sorts of concerns.
How about blind and partially sighted people who might like to work in this area? It seems like it's potentially an area that blind and partially sighted people could work in. I think you mentioned your colleague earlier who has sight loss. What advice would you offer for anyone listening who would like to perhaps get some professional experience?
Yeah, look, I'd encourage it, absolutely. So, you know, we look to employ blind and partially sighted people where we can. So, yeah, I mean, I absolutely encourage it. And I think if you're keen and interested in tech, and you're interested in voice interfaces and so on, then I think it's a fabulous place to get experience. And, you know, we're always looking for good people and talking to people and so on about that. So if you're a techie out there and interested in working in this space, then certainly get in touch with us or any of the other, you know, sort of speech organisations that are starting to emerge. And I absolutely encourage people to join this area.
Nick Howden from Real Thing, thank you very much.
Thank you, Dave. Thanks for having me on.
And that's all we've got time for here on Tech Talk. Thanks to all our guests and, of course, our co-hosts, Callum Stoneman and Tasneem Arshad. Good to have you with us as always. And don't forget, it is your programme. We'd love to hear from you. Please do get in touch with all your thoughts around technology, positive, less positive or indifferent. It's always great to receive your emails. That address, one more time, it's techtalk@rnib.org.uk. techtalk@rnib.org.uk. From myself, Dave Williams, and the rest of the team, until next time, bye for now.